You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stopped, opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text SUNNY to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text SUNNY to 200-300. That's SUNNY to 200-300. SUNNY to 200-300.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Represented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code Dan for a special offer when you sign up. That's code Dan, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Welcome to Meadowlarkers 43, the Dennis Eckersley episode here today. We are joined, Amin is here as well, are joined by ESPN investigative reporter, senior writer, TJ Quinn. TJ, thank you for joining us here on Meadowlarkers.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So we've tried to, over the last few months, check in on the Brittany Griner story, make sure that, unlike a lot of media outlets, we are trying to stay on top of it, offer our listeners whatever the latest is, whatever the background is. And I think since we have you on, I'm also interested, and I don't know if Amin might be as well, in addition to a lot of the information about Brittany, I'm just interested in, as a reporter, how you go about trying to report a story like this, which can be very different than some other investigative pursuits previously. So, but just off the top, TJ, can you tell us, in February, when you know, the New York Times, I believe, broke the original story, but how you started to get involved and kind of get your footing on this?
Yeah, nobody knew about, outside of the people immediately involved, nobody knew about it until March 5th. That's when that Times story was. And they were writing off of a story from TASS, Soviet, the Russian news agency. Wow. Those of us who grew up in the Cold War remember TASS, from the Soviet Union. For some reason, it was really quiet up until that point. I got involved in it because, as far as people in the ESPN's investigative unit go, I was the one who had some experience with Russia. So it just kind of fell in my lap. We had been there 4 years ago for a story we did about Vladimir Putin's involvement in international sport and how everything that he does in the sports world, the World Cup, the Olympics, even smaller federation events, they're all part of his geopolitical goals. And so we had kind of a head start, at least in understanding this issue in the sports world. And one of the things that we knew from the start was, two things are true. One is that Vladimir Putin's government absolutely has a history of framing people on drug crimes in particular. And we also know that sometimes athletes do dumb things and get caught doing it. So either was possible. It's, we're at a point now where she pleaded guilty, and a number of people in this country have taken that to mean, oh, that means she definitely did it, because why else would she admit guilt? Sitting here today, I don't know for sure that she did. Just because she told a Russian court that she did what she was accused of, bringing vape cartridges with hash oil, it was a foregone conclusion she was going to be found guilty. And the people involved also know there was no way Russia was going to agree to a deal to send her home unless there was an admission of guilt. So whether she did it or not, in the Russian court, she was going to be guilty. Whether she did it or not, she had to admit it. So is it possible that she did? I don't know. But the U.S. government decided fairly early on in her case that she was being wrongfully detained. That happened, I believe that was in May, they made that decision. So since then, everything about the trial was just kind of theater. Russia kept saying, we won't even discuss a deal until the court system is finished. Even though the rest of the world and any objective person, you know, knows how ridiculous the criminal justice system is there, Russia requires everybody to treat it as though it's real. And so when the U.S. government talked about maybe making a prisoner swap to get her home, Russia was adamant, no, we won't talk about this till it's over. Now that it's over, the number of people I've spoken to have said we're in a really critical phase. This is right now where it's being hashed out. It doesn't sound like a deal is imminent, but one thing I've learned in this topic over the past 5 months is you don't hear what's going on until it's over. The people I talk to who are involved say that they are optimistic, but they also know when you're dealing with Russia, things could blow up in any second. You could have a deal that you think is all set and signed off on, and somebody from the Kremlin comes in and says, no, we're not going to do this. I want something else. And it could all blow up. You don't even know always who you're negotiating with in Russia. You have, it's not just the Kremlin, the FSB, the foreign ministry. Sometimes it's elements, warring factions within those groups. So these things are incredibly tricky. It's never as obvious as the swap that people, you know, in the general public think are being discussed. But right now, from what I've heard, the fact that it's very quiet, we're not hearing any bluster from the two governments, that's a really good sign for Brittany Griner.
TJ, what are the complications in reporting a story like this, you know, that takes place in Russia? And how has that changed from the story that you did 4 years ago?
Well, it's a, I mean, Russia's changed dramatically since then, right? I mean, it was a very different time. You know, I'm not getting political, but just objectively, it's true that Donald Trump's relationship with Putin was very different than Joe Biden's. We went over there. I mean, look, even when we went, we got pretty good warnings about how to conduct ourselves. Don't bring your own phone. Don't bring your own laptop. Bring burners, because as soon as you open something there, it will be infected. When you bring it back, don't even turn it on. Hand it to your IT so they can wipe it. We were warned you will be surveilled. Don't try to detect it and don't try to avoid it. Because if you do, they'll see that as tradecraft and they'll treat you like a spy. Again, there's people in the U.S. intelligence community we spoke to who said all their journalists are spies. So they think all our journalists are spies. But as long as you don't act like one, they won't treat you like one. But you should have seen me checking, you know, my bag before I went over, any prescription medication, anything I had, because they will grab people. Now, of course, with the war in Ukraine, it's completely different. We did briefly talk about going over there, and it was made clear that it was described to me as a spectacularly bad idea. So that idea came and went quickly. But the biggest thing is you can't go over there yourself. You can't try to talk to her. You can't just go talk to the lawyers that she has over there. You don't really have access to the government. So all the information that you're getting, that we're getting, is really through people in this country, whether it's the State Department, the White House, you know, anybody who's around Brittany Griner. No matter... They may be right on every point, but they still have a vested interest in this. And whether, you know, Brittany Griner is being wrongfully detained or not, I need to keep in mind with every one of these people I talk to, they do have an agenda. Most people may agree with it, maybe just. But when I hear, like when I ask how is she doing over there, I'm hearing what they want me to hear. I have no way to objectively confirm that. And the fact is, it is in her supporters' interest to not paint too dramatic a picture. They can't say she's being horribly treated, because that could create a whole, you know, another level of problems. They don't want to say she's doing great. I mean, I can't imagine she is. Prison system in this country isn't exactly a spa, and Russia is a lot rougher than that. So you don't really know. You're limited in who you can talk to, but there's also another level to it. Like any other investigation that I work on, you get as much as you can, you go with it, you judge the news value. But here you've got a whole other level of, especially early on, are you repeating Russian propaganda points? Are you doing something that could potentially put her in danger? I mean, in the sports world, we may act like everything is an issue of national security. This is literally an issue of national security. We act like it's life and death. This one actually affects, you know, the life of a woman who has been over there for 6 months. And you always have to make decisions with that in mind.
When you went over 4 years ago and it, it sounds like, TJ, I assume you're talking about the ESPN security that is telling you about, you know, the threats at various countries.
No, that was actually U.S. intelligence. We had reached out to people at a number of agencies. We did, of course, consult with ESPN because they won't let you go anywhere. I mean, you know, they won't let you go anywhere. With I had to have a bodyguard in Vegas, which was to this day, don't understand. But anyway, yeah, they don't mess around. But we went to the intelligence community for advice about what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of in retrospect feeling exposed about when I went over there in 2017. I mean, nobody tried to stop me. Nobody told me not to bring my own phone. Nobody gave me any pointers, really. They were just like, good luck. And that was the year I went over to actually Ekaterinburg, which was the team that Brittany and at the time Diana Taurasi were playing for, UMMC. And so when in early March, as you said earlier, when we first heard that Brittany was detained and subsequently, you know, deemed unlawfully, my main question on the table was, is her team, her Russian team, going to be able to step in before this escalates to where it has gotten? When you were in the early stages, did you have any intel? I mean, I know one of her teammates at UMMC and one of the administrators on her team was at her trial, but was there ever a phase where there was going to be a point where maybe her team could step in and keep this from escalating?
I think that's what they were hoping for early on. Because if you remember, until the U.S. State Department made that declaration, she was wrongfully detained. They were trying really hard to keep this low key. And, they reached out to us and pretty much anybody in the media saying, please, we're trying not to make too much of this. Because even though, look, we're all aware of what Russia's history with this is and what she faced over there and the dangers she faced. There, if the thought at the time from both the State Department and from her supporters was, I mean, the people around her, her family, her agents, if there is any chance to get her out without turning this into an international event or a hostage situation, then they wanted to try to do it. Once it was clear that, no, they're looking to deal her, then, okay, everything changed. And they said, let the hounds, release the hounds and put as much pressure on the White House as you could. So I think they were waiting to see what could the team do, but more particularly the oligarch who owned the team. Because all the years that she was going over there, if you're going over there, and she's been going since 2014, if you're under the protection of an oligarch, it's like walking into a neighborhood in this country where a mob boss or a gang leader says, you're okay. If you've got the protection and the okay of that person, you can go safely. And I don't know what efforts there were if that particular oligarch, and I can't believe I'm blanking on his name right now, but he owns the mining companies over there, estimated worth at least $3.5 billion. Once the war started, which was 1 week after she was detained, remember the reaction of Western nations, including the U.S. and the U.K., was to freeze assets of all those oligarchs. That's if you want to understand the power system in Russia, it's all about the relationship between Putin and the oligarchs. He keeps himself in power because they keep him in power. He keeps them happy by funneling money to them. It is essentially a criminal operation. And that's why the U.S. was seizing yachts and properties all over the world. So I don't know if there were efforts to reach out to him directly, but I know that if anybody could have stepped in historically and said, no, she's with me, that's who it would have been. But suddenly their assets are frozen. I don't know particularly what's happened with his, but I think that that's really what they were waiting for. And like you said, her one of her teammates and the GM of the team appeared at her trial on her behalf. That's a guts. I mean, that's when the government has said, somebody's guilty of something and two people who have to live there come out on her behalf. Look, maybe they have some assurances that they'll be okay, but that was really a gutsy thing to do.
TJ, obviously there's a lot of frustration about her situation, the desire to get her back. I see that frustration boil over a lot on social media and even in newscasts where people are demanding that the White House and President Biden do something. What is it exactly do they expect to be done when dealing with a nation that is a rival nation, a frosty relationship, and a nuclear power, among other things? What is it that people expect the White House or the U.S. government to do?
That, I mean, it's a great question. It's you know, when people were talking about protesting in the beginning, I think some were thinking they were protesting against Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin does not care what anybody in this country thinks about Brittany Griner or anybody else, if he even knows her name. He's got a lot bigger things to deal with at the moment than one basketball player. The protests were about pressuring the White House to cut a deal to bring her home, more specifically to do a prisoner swap. There's a guy, and you guys, I'm sure you've discussed him, arms dealer named Victor Boot, who is doing a 25-year sentence in this country. He was, you know, one of the things he was convicted of was, you know, conspiring to take the lives of Americans. It's not like, you know, he was busted with less than an ounce of weed. It's not exactly an equal trade. On the other hand, he has spent 14 years in custody already. The U.S. picked him up in Thailand 14 years ago. The thought behind that, and behind former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, and his organization, Richardson has worked for years to get people like Brittany Griner home, and his organization is engaged on this as well. Their point is, you're not going to create more incentive to kidnap Americans abroad by trading to get them home. Just get them home. Now, there's a fascinating piece that was just published in the Journal of Foreign Affairs today by Professor Danny Gilbert, who we've interviewed a number of times. She's kind of, I would say, the foremost expert on state-sponsored hostage taking, making the case that, yeah, actually, it does create incentive, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. It means that the efforts should be put into preventing nations from doing it in the first place, disincentivizing it, and making sure that you punish people who are involved. Now, the White House announced executive action, I believe it was in July, by President Biden to do, I think it was August, whatever, it all blends together, essentially to do that, to designate Russia is a country where people could be illegally detained, tools to let them go after anybody who was involved in the illegal detention of an American. There are a number of steps. I'd encourage anybody to find Danny Gilbert's piece in Foreign Policy, but Foreign Affairs. And, you know, when you talk to people in the government, they say, look, we get it. The families are frustrated. They want us to make a deal at any cost. If you're Brittany Griner's wife, if you're her family or a sibling or anybody in her life, you won't care about U.S. foreign policy or geopolitical goals or what this does to NATO you want to get them home. So they understand that. But there's also, you hear frustration from them saying, hey, you know, we're just as invested as any other person in trying to get Americans back. We want to do this. People overlook the fact that you're dealing with Russia, which is not exactly the most reasonable negotiating partner. They're the ones who have her. They're the ones who are setting terms. They're the ones holding her. And that the U.S. can't just do this at any cost. One of the stories that came out, I forget who was it, broke it, it might have been CNN, was that Russia had asked in return for a Russian national who's in prison in Germany right now for a murder he was convicted of in Belgium. The U.S. has no say over that. And the reaction from the U.S. State Department was, well, that's not a serious response. And when I talked to people who live in this world, they said their theory was Russia knew we wouldn't agree to that, but it's a way to put a wedge between the U.S. and Germany, anything to destabilize relationships. So there are probably things that are going on that we don't hear about and may never hear about. People are still optimistic she'll come home, and we may hear about some kind of swap, Victor Boot, and maybe somebody going there for Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan. But there's a very good chance there will be elements of this we never hear about.
What's your best guess for Russia's motivation behind all of this?
I mean, with the huge caveat that I couldn't begin to get inside the mind of Vladimir Putin or anybody who works for him. What we know from their history is they are purely transactional. There's a guy they want. This is a way to get it. So, I mean, there are multiple goals, really. One is they've wanted Victor Boot for a long time. He's become kind of a folk hero over there. And from what I understand, there's artwork that he's done that's displayed around Moscow. Somebody is really interested in getting him home. I don't know who it is or why. But they want him. But on the other hand, it's also one more way to make Joe Biden look ineffective and weak, which is absolutely a goal of Putin's. Anything to destabilize this country and to stir up political unrest. One of the calculations in this, You've got Paul Whelan, who is a white male, former military in his 50s. Brittany Griner, who is a black lesbian who has been very active. There is absolutely a political recognition that if you bring one home, you're going to set off a firestorm if you don't bring home the other. And Russia has a media ecosystem and its use of social media that is designed to inflame those U.S. divisions. I mean, the record is so clear and so substantial through every election. I can tell, you know, anytime I tweet anything about this, these bots start coming. It's like almost like there's a shift change in Moscow, where all these accounts that were created in the last month with two followers, and both of those are porn sites, suddenly repeating all the same talking points, and they get in your feed and they just try to stir it up. So that's always a motivation for what Russia is doing, just to mess up U.S. politics.
I mean, to that point, you know, when this topic comes up, just in like out to dinner with people, conversations over the last few months, there's like this default thing that people are saying, which is, well, if it was LeBron James detained over there, we'd be talking about it nonstop. And I'm like, if LeBron James was detained over there, Russia would be asking for us to like resurrect bin Laden or something. You know what I mean? There would be some astronomical cost associated with it. I just think you can almost see the machinations of what Russia is trying to do work in the U.S. as we start. Not that I don't think that there's things that play about the reason why Britney was over there, there being inequity in the sports world, et cetera, et cetera. That's separate from how we're actually dealing with it right now and trying to get Britney Griner home. I don't sense, and I have not been, you know, reporting this story over the last few months, I don't sense there's disinterest in the U.S. government because she's a female athlete. I don't know whether, as you've been reporting it, TJ, there seems to be any sort of, I guess, lesser motivation because of that, that you have noticed.
No, there's certainly less attention. And if LeBron James had been grabbed, it's hard to imagine 3 weeks could have gone by before anybody noticed, right? That's just the difference in yeah, the level of celebrity each of them is. Kate, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, anyone I've spoken to has said if they had LeBron, they'd be asking for the moon. It would be way more valuable to them because of the amount of pressure it would create for the Biden White House. I'm not relying so much on my conversations with people, you know, directly in the U.S. government, because, I mean, what are they going to tell me, that they're disinterested? No, I mean, they seem to be motivated, but you have to go by actions. What I can tell you is that her case is moving more quickly than similar cases have gone. Paul Whelan has been there for almost four years. He was not declared. He was in pretrial detention for 18 months. And it wasn't until after he was convicted that he was declared wrongfully detained. Same with Trevor Reed, who was a former Marine who came home in late April. So hers has actually gone more quickly. What I'm relying on, though, are the people around in Brittany Griner's world and other independent people who are experts on this. And what they tell me is they believe that the government is engaged. They believe that the State Department has a priority. Now, they may disagree with some things like, you know, the timing. You hear some impatience. I mean, one day in a Russian jail would be too much, much less 6 months. But when you talk to them, what they say is they really feel like our government is working in good faith, and they understand, you know, it's when I hear people in the State Department saying, you know, look, we know why they want to put pressure on the president, but it doesn't help anything. We're motivated to do this. But when I talk to Paul Whelan's siblings, for example, they're like, no, we get why people do that. It's, if Biden is the guy who has to sign off on the deal, wouldn't you do absolutely everything you could to put pressure on him? I can't say if the pressure has helped or not, but, you know, there's also a sense in those people that I talk to that, yeah, maybe it has pushed it. And maybe if it was LeBron James, there would be such a continued outcry, and every member of Congress, or at least half the members of Congress, would be screaming to get him home. Half would be screaming to keep him there. But there would be, you know, a lot more pressure on him, and maybe they make a deal more quickly. I don't know. But like I said, the people around Brittany Griner seem to feel they're operating in good faith.
When TJ, when you mentioned at the outset that part of the reason you got tapped to cover this story was because I assume it was for the World Cup in 2018 that you did a piece on Russia and Russian sport and Putin. Did you learn anything in the process of reporting that 4 years ago that has at least influenced how you think about what is happening now?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a natural tendency when you don't understand a subject to do a little bit of both-sidism simply because you're not confident enough in the topic. I am not an expert on Russia or, you know, U.S.-Russian foreign policy, but I've talked to a lot of people who are. And I think the advantage, you know, to me of having done that before was to come into this with a little more of a clear-eyed view than I might have had otherwise about the way the Russian system works. You know, it was a long time on that story understanding, yes, Putin operates as a criminal. You cannot... There are people who even say, why do you call him president? The guy's a dictator. He murders political opponents. He has people whacked in other countries. So it frames the way you talk about it from the beginning. And I did see some reporting. I've seen reporting throughout. When something happens in a Russian court, you see American press react to it as though it's a normal U.S. trial. We can go into, you know, all the issues of the U.S. judicial system, you know. Other countries love to point out the flaws, but the fact is there's no difference. You know, there's really no comparison between the flaws in our judicial system and the way Russia's operates. Russia's is a purely transactional system. It is built entirely to convict people. Fewer than 1% of all cases end in acquittal. Judges are hired and trained to convict. If you get a public defender over there, the public defender works with the prosecutor. The system is so completely stacked. If you're the regular, you know, Russian citizen, much less an American who's, you know, of some value to them. So I think that experience helped a lot. And also just being able to reach out to the sources right away, who I talked to before, who were able to quickly get me up to speed on the Russian legal system. You know, the one point I kept trying to hammer through all our reporting during the trial was you can't treat this like a normal trial. It's theater. It's a foregone conclusion. This is just to stir up division and try to give the whole process a sheen of legitimacy. And if I've seen a mistake in the U.S. press, I think it's not contextualizing it that way.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike. And typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right. You crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Where do we go from here? I mean, she's in Russian prison. You said that probably the silence on both sides is a good sign that means negotiation is happening. But beyond that, is this just, I mean, are we looking at waiting out 9.5 years or whatever her sentence is?
I mean, yeah, it's a 9-year sentence. It's, the people I talk to say with confidence, it's not going to be that long. Does that mean a week, 2 weeks? Does that mean 6 months? It's hard to say. Like I said, you know, Trevor Reed was there more than 2.5 years. Paul Whelan has been there for almost four. You know, they wanted to come home too. There's no way to put a date on it. Right now she's still in a Russian jail. Well, everything, of course, it's Russian, whatever. She's in a jail in Moscow while she has filed an appeal, as expected. What people on this side of the ocean, of the hemisphere, of the globe are hoping is that she doesn't end up getting sent to the penal colony that she's been sentenced to, because that's a whole other ballgame. There's a real chance for, these are work camps. I mean, they're They're prehistoric. They're it's also a place where, you know, being a 6'9", you know, black woman who's a lesbian in a country that is, you know, incredibly intolerant legally, officially, the LGBTQ plus community. That's where her identity and her celebrity could make her a real risk for abuse. So right now, if she's in a Russian, if she's in a jail instead of that penal colony, she's in a much better position. You know, the people I talk to, they seem fairly impatient, but they get that, look, this is what needs to happen. You know, it's at some point what you'd expect. I mean, usually you don't hear anything until somebody's on a plane and out of Russian airspace and suddenly the word goes out, Brittany Griner's been released. In this case, the sense I get is that if there is not progress, or if the U.S. government feels the Russian government is not dealing in good faith, we're likely to hear something from the State Department again. I mean, when Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke up last month admitting that there had actually been an offer from the U.S., that was completely unprecedented. And it sounded like it was because they were just frustrated with what they were getting back from the Russians. So the next thing you hear will either be, you know, she's on her way home, or that the U.S. is throwing up its hands and unhappy with Russia.
I'm going to pitch a podcast here, a separate one than the Meadowlarkers, but I listened a couple of weeks ago to 544 days, which was
Jason Rezaian,
in detained in Tehran for whatever that amounts to, almost 2 years, and it was similarly to what you've been articulating today, TJ. Just did you listen to that?
I have, and I've had the good fortune to talk to Jason a couple times about his there as well, and his book, which is a fantastic read.
And just the nuances of the last minute hangups that can come up in some sort of swap or exchange that he details in 544 of like, no, your wife can't get on the plane with you, and it holds up the whole deal. And I mean, just down to the last minute of these things, it being up in the air. But I also wanted to follow up on the appeal process, because I think maybe all of us, or at least I know I am, projecting, mapping like an American appeal process onto the Russian judicial system of appeals can take years. And maybe it's a good thing for Brittany if it does take years, because if she's not transferred to the penal colony until the appeal is over, then that's probably good. But like, how do appeals play out?
The first thing about Russian appeals is they are almost uniformly unsuccessful, right? So, I mean, again, it's a foregone conclusion. It's more theater. And from their standpoint, it's their way of saying, hey, she's getting a fair shake over here. From the U.S. government standpoint, it's a way of knowing that she's in a secure place until this is finished. I've talked to people who said that their big fear is that somebody in Russia says, to hell with this, put her in the penal colony anyway. You know, that would be incredibly upsetting to the U.S. government. What could they actually do about it? I don't know. This isn't like, you know, people I've talked to who are held in places like Syria or Somalia, where you can send SEAL Team 6 in to get them out. This is, you know, I mean, like you were saying, this is a nuclear power. You can't just, you know, send in the commandos. You are at their mercy to some extent. But the fact is, Russia's motivated as well. They want to get these guys. You know, it was interesting that the whole thing last week over the weekend with Dennis Rodman saying he was going. I haven't seen any evidence that that's actually true, but I spoke to a number of people who said they could absolutely see a scenario where if he did get involved, Vladimir Putin would want to make it look like Rodman was the one who got her out because it would, you know, it would make Biden look foolish. Yeah. And then it would be, you know, and then you give the whole social media monster in this country something to chew over, and they just sit back and crack up while the U.S. tears itself apart. So the U.S. government, you know, State Department was pretty quick to put out a statement saying this would not be helpful. Our government cannot prevent him from going. And it's up to the U.S. You know, there's a do not travel order, but it's not enforced. If he did go over there and met with people who are being sanctioned or by the U.S. government, he could potentially be prosecuted. But I mean, that would be hell of a political move to try to prosecute somebody for trying to get somebody home. Whatever, but just, I mean, Kate, it's like you said, all these wild cards that can come down to the last second. You it's incredibly tense.
How does this impact the future relations between the United States and Russia? Is this just another kind of piece of antagonism in a long list of antagonisms that have happened and are going to happen? Or will we remember this? Will this be memorialized in history books as this was where things really got ugly?
Well, it's a really interesting question because you've got, there's a war going on and the U.S. is behind Ukraine and Russia is not happy about it. And the two governments are at as hostile a place as they've been since the Cold War. So the invasion of Ukraine obviously is a lot bigger than the detention of one basketball player. But what was interesting is the fact that there are channels at all. When Trevor Reed was sent home in late April, that was the best news that Brittany Griner's supporters could have gotten because it meant there is a diplomatic channel open. Mm-hmm. And there's a history of that, with other conflicts where two countries can be at war, but they still have some diplomatic communications. In some cases, it's non-existent. It's not like we're dealing with ISIS necessarily. But even with the Taliban, we were at war with, there were mm-hmm. still discussions between those countries. So the tricky part right now for the U.S. government is, can they manage this to bring Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan home right now while this is going on? Or is Russia going to shut things down because they'll demand that the U.S. Do something like lift sanctions or agree not to arm Ukraine or something? We haven't heard anything to that effect. But that could be like, if there's a danger out there, even if it's remote, that's one of them, that Russia suddenly changes the terms of the discussion to make it about the war, and then you could be completely stuck. So it is kind of fascinating that, yeah, this is a major break in these points, and you can't see the two governments ever reconciling it while Vladimir Putin is in power. But they can at least conduct business, which is kind of fascinating.
So every time that there's been a moment in the case where, Brittany is brought out, and we have pictures of her and we have a quick video of her. The last few times that has happened, she gets put behind in the little cage inside the courtroom, right? This is my limited Russian judiciary system knowledge. But the last few times she's been holding up photos that of things that have happened in the US. Like, for example, at one point she was holding up a photo of the WNBA All-Star game when they, were wearing her number. And my mind starts churning about, like, why was she given these photos? Like, what is the manipulation that's supposed to be happening with me right now? Because what my emotional reaction to it was, wow, Brittany is in a Russian jail, but she's seeing that the U.S. still cares about her. But then somebody in Russia gave her that photo. So, like, I don't know how much you have thought about this. Like, why are they giving her? I mean, it's essentially kind of propaganda. Like, what's the purpose of that?
No, it's a fascinating thing. When she gets that, those are printouts that her lawyers in Russia give her. She has a legal team there that is from everyone I've spoken to, as good a team as you can have, frankly. They work for her, not for the government. And of course, there are limitations to them, to what they can do because of the system and the fact they have to live there. But early on, I think one of the first times she was brought out for a hearing, her people over here saw that she was able to carry something with her and recognized that as a potential way for her to send a message home. And so that's really what she's doing. It's sort of a shout out to people here. Hey, I know you're there. Particular her wife, Sherelle, she's gotten information. She's gotten letters from people that her lawyers are able to bring to her. It's all heavily monitored. And she's been able to write notes back, which has been a big deal to them. To my understanding, she has still not been able to speak to anybody. And then there was a letter that she wrote that was delivered to President Biden on July 4th, sent through her lawyers, and then was delivered here. So that's really been her way of sending a message home saying, I'm okay. I'm thinking about you. I know about the support.
It's just really hard because, like you said, everything's monitored. Everything has to be greenlit by somebody with more nefarious motives than her lawyers. So you're constantly thinking, well, why did they let her write a letter to President Biden. I guess at that point, you just assume that they wanted to stay in the media to some degree. They want to continue to have her value be high. I mean, I just assume that these are the reasons why anything at all is allowed.
I think that's exactly right. It's all those things. The more we talk about it over here, the more pressure there is on the White House to make a deal that Russia's happy with. If this was all really quiet, the Biden White House could be as patient as it wanted to be. I mean, again, I'm not saying they're trying to slow roll it at all, but just they have in mind what they think is reasonable and what isn't. The more pressure there is, the more likelihood that the president picks up the phone and says, get this done. So Russia has the same motivation that they do, that supporters of Brittany Griner do, create pressure on the White House to make a deal.
Earlier, you talked about how, at least to this point, what's happening with Brittany Griner has not been directly entangled with what's happening with the incursion in Ukraine. It was just announced that the U.S. has agreed to send $3 billion worth of arms to the Ukraine. How does that impact Brittany's situation?
I mean, the short, honest answer is I don't know. The people I've talked to have said that they recognize that any one particular, you know, step by the U.S. could lead to Russia responding, saying, you know, that's it. The deal's off. Mm-hmm. And they also recognize that Russia may just decide to milk it a little longer for whatever motivation somebody might have. The potential is there to make it more complicated. The people I've spoken to have said that so far the conversations have really been on a separate channel, which to them was a relief. Now, again, there may be other requests, and I'm not saying no one has suggested this is the case. Just talking to people, they have said these are possible things that Russia could ask for. Some oligarch wants his yacht back. Somebody wants the property that was seized in London back. Somebody wants to get their kid into an American school. So who knows?
Right.
You know, but those are the kinds of things we don't know about. And so the U.S. is just sort of at this place where you proceed as best you can, understanding that you're not dealing with somebody who deals in good faith.
Wow. Yeah. Just that. I mean, you know, you see these things on TV or in shows where it's like the shadowy world of how so-and-so got into this school and this. And, you know, and now you're seeing it kind of, not that we're seeing it intimately, but you're kind of getting the bird's eye view of how this actually plays out. TJ, before we let you go, just back to the journalism piece of this, what have you learned as an investigative journalist like throughout this process?
Oh, man, that is a really interesting question. I mean, it's been kind of fascinating. Like, I've been at this for a while, right? I've done, you know, I've been in journalism for 30 years. I've done investigative reporting for 20. It's weird to have a party involved in a story that you just have zero access to. I cannot make open records requests or Freedom of Information Act requests for Russian documents. There is no Freedom of Information Act in Russia. I can't go over there and knock on doors. I can't reach out to people. So you have to, I think it's been a reminder about remembering, I may have my own personal feelings about Brittany Griner and whether or not, you know, she should come home, but they have nothing to do with my job. And I have to remind myself that I'm not an advocate. I'm not a participant. I am an observer. My job is to tell this story as accurately as possible, to bear in mind constantly that I don't know what I don't know. If anything, it's been another great lesson in humility. I need to know that just because I did one story 4 years ago in Russia, I am not an expert. I need to know that just because one expert returns my phone calls, it doesn't mean he or she is the final authority on that topic. You know, you have to really kind of keep that professional distance. But at the same time, you know, to me, what's been crucial is so much of what's wrong with the press in this country right now is the inability to call something for what it is. There's an expression, you know, in our country, there's a journalism tradition of saying, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. There's an expression that I've come to like even more that I think is British. I saw somebody attribute it to some editor. If one person says it's raining and one person says it's not, my job isn't to write what both said. It's to open the effing window and look for myself. And this is a case where the media in this country need to understand sometimes you just have to open the effing window and look yourself. And that's, you can talk about the way Russia operates and not be an agent of the U.S. government. You can talk about the way Russia operates and not, not be anti-Russian. It's simply calling something for what it is.
TJ Quinn, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.